It has to boil down to a system, and it's got to be somewhat scientific. It can't just be, well, that one feels good. There's a lot of real estate investors that go with their gut. And I don't know if you can say going with your gut makes a good real estate deal. There may be some people out there with the most incredible instincts on planet Earth, and they could just look at a deal and somehow the deal speaks to them and they go, that is the property I will purchase. And maybe they're going to kill it, but you can't go off of that. What would your life look like if you could replace all of your working income with simple and conservative investments that could do it for you?
Over the last 13 years, we've helped thousands of clients transact over $500 million in simple and conservative real estate transactions, allowing them to begin replacing their work income with real estate investment income.
Each week, we'll be pulling back the curtain on the ins and outs of real-time, retirement-based real estate transactions that will transform your financial future, even if you have no real estate experience. This is Replace Your Income with me, Kevin Clayson.
And Steve Earle.
All right. Well, hello, everybody. Here we are. This is episode 6. Can you believe that we've already done 5 of these, Steve, and we're on 6?
No, I can't quite believe it.
It's kind of awesome. It's awesome. And I just got to say thank you so much to all of you that are listening and that are reviewing, and you're reaching out to us and you're giving us feedback and you're letting us know what you think of the podcast. And we are so appreciative of you, and we love doing this. This has been so much fun. And so listen, we got a lot more coming, right, Steve?
Hey, Kevin, I gotta tell you, it's like, you know how like unexcited I was about this, because I'm not one to, you know, get in front of people or even just like be talking to people, that kind of a thing. I'm more in the background kind of a guy, but this has been a lot of fun. I'm really enjoying these conversations with you.
Oh yeah.
We have these conversations all the time, right?
Yeah, we do.
And so, you know, getting in front of a microphone and kind of looking at each other while we talk, it actually feels pretty natural. And believe it or not, you know, you might not believe this, Kevin, but I'm actually enjoying myself. Yeah.
It's funny you say that. I'm glad you are, first of all. But I was talking to my wife the other day and I was like, you know, I love doing this with you because, like you just said, these are conversations that we've had time and time again, right? I mean, how many times during the day do you come into my office or I go into yours and then we talk about the kinds of things? This is just kind of, now we're getting an opportunity to share it with more people, which I hope, it seems like so far you guys are loving it. And so thank you for that.
Kevin, I think we're missing one thing though.
What's
that? Like many of these conversations happen over like lunch.
Yeah.
And we typically have chips and salsa.
Yes. You know,
while we're talking about these things. Like, would that be annoying to people if we were like dipping and crunching while we...
I could add a whole new dimension. Yeah, that would be good. Well, so today we have another awesome topic that we want to talk about. And today we want to talk about something that I know is a thing that Steve and I talk about a lot. And it's this question, okay? How do you tell if something's a good deal? How do you define a good deal when it comes to real estate? And I imagine by now this won't come as any sort of a surprise, but the way that Steve and I and the way that our company, the way we evaluate deals is quite a bit different than maybe others. You know, we're on Forbes.com. We get a chance to contribute on Forbes.com and participate in some forums and things there. And there was a question on Forbes.com recently, which was something to the effect of, you know, what's the number that matters the most in your real estate investing? And the answers were all over the map. And what was interesting is I know that, Steve, you and I have a very different sort of definition of what makes a good deal. It's not the standard, like a lot of people say, well, it's got to have so much equity. Or they'll say, well, it's got to have XYZ cap rate. Or, well, it's got to, you know, the rent that you collect has to be a certain percentage of the purchase price. And there's all of these ways that people define or evaluate a good deal. And we're going to kind of take issue with that from the standpoint that we don't believe that those conventional standards, that those conventional metrics are the best way to evaluate a deal, especially not through the lens of income replacement over time. Right, Steve?
Yeah. A lot of those rules of thumb are good. And sometimes they help you just kind of do a real quick review. It's like, hey, is this something that's worth my time to take a closer look at? But definitely how we define a good deal is not super conventional, because we have a lot of different criteria that are maybe different. And I'm excited to jump into those.
Yeah. I think that, and this is something you talk a lot about, Steve, and one of the ways that we look at deals differently is through this lens, okay? It is the lens of perspective. And I know that you have a really awesome perspective on the idea of perspective. I feel like we're in the movie Inception now. We're just going layers down. But so talk to that, Steve, because I love the way that you phrase this and talk about this.
Yeah, you know, I think perspective and how we look at the world, like we all look at the world very differently, right? We have a number of different people listening to us here today. And everybody is hearing what we're saying just slightly differently based on their experiences in life, based on, you know, what's happened, you know, the decisions that they made, you know, maybe turned out one way or another. And so they kind of view life, and we all view investing in real estate a little bit differently. And so how we look at something is absolutely critical. And so maybe to illustrate this a little bit, Kev, like, would you mind if I kind of like indulge, you know, a little bit and just share a personal story? I don't want to make this super personal, but maybe I could just share.
I think it's okay to make it personal. And I think I know what story you're going to tell, and it's 100% okay, because I love this story because it taught me something that I've never forgotten. So are you going to tell the story about?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So I guess it was about 10 years ago, 2010, it's Labor Day weekend. So it's Monday morning. I wake up, my wife wakes up. We decided we wanted to take a ride up a canyon on our tandem. So I bought my wife a tandem bicycle a couple of years ago for her birthday. She has kind of some bad balance, and so she can't ride a bike by herself anymore. And so we got this tandem. She can ride on the back. And so anyways, we get up and we go on this ride. We head up the canyon, and we rode up the canyon about almost 10 miles.
Oh, wow.
We went all the way up to this waterfall. We look at the waterfall, and by this time, we left fairly early. It was about 8 a.m. or 9 a.m. or so at this point. We look at the waterfall. It's like really pretty and all. And now it's time to ride back down the canyon. And it's a little bit cool, and we'd kind of worked going up the canyon. So we're riding down. We get to this little turnoff that kind of goes off the beaten path and up, you know, probably 200-300 yards kind of off the path. And we're going up there. The sunlight's just kind of cresting over the mountains now and illuminating, you know, the east side of the mountains. And we're straddling the bike. We're kind of looking up, and I'm talking to her. And all of a sudden she's like, my arm really hurts. I'm like, huh. It's like, well, you're probably pulling really hard on the handlebars, and you know, your arm's probably just aching from that. And she's like, it's getting worse. And so I'm like, well, maybe get off your bike and sit down for a minute, like kind of like move it around. And just as she gets off the bike, like it hits her and she like falls down. And like, it's at this point that I realized the pain she's having was in her left arm. And it's at this point I realized she's having a heart attack. And I'm like, what? My wife is like 41 years old. Like, how is she having a heart attack? Anyway, she's lying down there. And I kind of lay her down on my lap, and I'm trying to, you know, help her kind of work through this. And the way she described it is like, it's like an elephant sitting on her chest. And so I'm kind of starting to panic at this point. We're off the beaten path. We don't have our cell phones with us. I can't call anybody. And I'm like, what do I do? Do I like leave my wife and like run and see if I can find somebody on the path? Or do I stay here and get ready to do CPR? And at about that point, this guy pulls up on his bike, and he's got his two little boys with him, like two little kids. They're probably like 5 and 8 years old or so. And he's like, hey, what's going on? Are you guys okay? And I'm like, I think my wife's having a heart attack. I was like, can you like stay here with her? I'm going to run and get some help. And he's like, I'll help with whatever I can. And just as I'm like standing up to go to get some help, I see this white little pickup truck driving towards us on this little service road. And it happens to be a county sheriff.
Oh my gosh.
And so he pulls up. He's like, hey, are you guys all right? And I was like, my wife's having a heart attack. And so he radios in, and things kind of like miraculously fall into place. Like within, like literally, I'm telling you, within like 10 minutes or less, probably 5 minutes, there's an ambulance there picking her up. And as they're loading her into the ambulance, this guy and his two little boys who stayed with me, you know, he's like, hey, don't worry about your bike. It's, you know, this is a big tandem bike. He's like, my truck is just down the road. I'll take it. I'll load it. I'll take it home. Here's my phone number and my address. When things get figured out, like, give me a call. And so I jump in the ambulance, and we go to the hospital. And by the time we get there, there's a surgeon waiting. And literally within 15 minutes, she's in surgery, having heart surgery. And, you know, later that day in the afternoon, I'm sitting in her hospital room, and we're having a conversation, just kind of talking about like this crazy experience we just went through. So it was like a week or two later, my wife and I went over to this guy's house. We called him up. We're like, hey, my wife's okay. Thank you so much for your help. We'd like to come pick up the bike. He's like, yeah, come on over, pick it up. So we get over there and we're just having short conversations, you know, on his driveway. And he's like, I've got to tell you like the most interesting thing. So, you know, later in that day, my 8-year-old son comes out and I can tell he's got this kind of interesting expression on his face. He looks a little bit worried. He's like, Dad, he's like, can I talk to you about something? I'm like, oh boy, here we go. I got to have this life and death conversation with my son about, you know, this woman who like was dying right in front of his eyes. He's like, Dad, it's like, you know, while I was standing there and looking at all this going on, he's like, I just never thought I'd ever see a bike with two seats and two handlebars. And I'm like, what? Here's this lady on the ground, like literally dying in front of his eyes. And the only thing this little kid could think about was that he was looking at the coolest bike he's ever seen in his life. Right. And I'm like, perspective, right? Yeah. His perspective in life was, I don't know what's even happening to this lady.
Right.
But this cool blue bike with two handlebars and two seats is the coolest thing I've ever seen in my life. And I think that that's how we kind of approach life, right? Depending on our experience. His perspective was he didn't even know what was happening to this lady. My perspective in that situation was my wife is dying. It's yeah, like, I could have cared less about this bike. And so perspective, right? It's the lens through which we all see what's going on around us. And so real estate investing is the type of thing where having some perspective or being able to tap into someone else's perspective to help you understand for purposes of this conversation, what makes a good deal is extremely important. Because if you've never bought before, maybe you have bought before, but you're looking maybe to maybe do it a little bit differently. Because let's face it, at the end of the day, most people who succeed in real estate investing, you know, have success by accident.
Yeah.
It's not because they had some magical plan or that they had done dozens of deals and so they know what they knew what worked or what didn't work, right? And so as quickly as that success may have come, it can go away just as quickly if you don't have some perspective and some experience to kind of go along with that. And so, you know, that lends itself to this conversation we're going to have today about what makes a good deal.
Yeah, and I love that concept of perspective because there's a lot of people who will share their perspective of what makes a good deal. In fact, if you're listening to this podcast or if you're somebody that listens to a lot of real estate podcasts, you could listen to 10 or 12 or 20 different investment podcasts and you may hear 10 or 12 or 20 different ideas of what makes a good deal. And so what I'm excited to kind of share with everybody here today, Steve, is we're not coming at this from the standpoint of one deal that worked well for you or one deal that worked well for me, but we're talking about literally thousands and thousands of single family residences that have performed exceptionally well for our clients over the last nearly 13 years and saying, okay, based on this perspective, right? This is more than just an isolated deal where, you know, you may have talked to somebody who found one screaming deal and they were able to get it and they tell you, you know, it had 20% equity and that deal worked out so well for them that they may tell you for the rest, they maybe go write a book and say, in order to do good real estate, you got to have a 20% equity position because that's the approach that they're going to take based on their perspective that came as a result of their experience. So what we hope to share today is our perspective, not just based on our personal individual experience, but on the experience of over 1,000 clients and thousands of deals. What is it that makes a good deal? And I kind of teased this earlier, but I'll say it again. What we're about to share, Steve, I have not heard anybody else in the industry describe a good deal in the way that we evaluate it and the way that we look at it. And so let's get into the basics. What are the mechanics or what are those things that we qualify as a good deal? And maybe we start with this one because this is the one that I think is the kind of biggest, like, wait, what? And when we share it with people, they kind of go, huh? You got to be crazy, which is this. Most people think that a good deal means that you've got to go buy it with a certain amount of equity or you've got to buy it for cheaper than, you know, maybe what it's worth or something like that. Steve, what do we think about that?
Yeah, let me talk to that real quick. This whole concept of, like, first and foremost, we kind of look at things from the perspective of we're not swinging for the fences, right? We're hitting singles.
That's right.
So that's the perspective from which we come. So in terms of like having like this instant equity, to talk to that, that is a fallacy in and of itself. A home, a real estate property will sell for what somebody is willing to pay for it. And if you have a property, let's say that you have two properties in a neighborhood, and let's say that the comparables are stating that the typical home in this neighborhood is $200,000, and you see a property that you could buy for $150,000. So you're like, $50,000 equity. Like the reality is, well, what is that $50,000, in equity? It's not magic. What it is, 99% of the time, is something needs to be done to that home that's going to cost about $50,000.
Probably, yeah.
And the true equity that you have in that home is whether or not you have the ability to get that work done for less expensively than at market cost. That's your equity.
Yeah.
Like that's the reality of it. And so the moment you've done those repairs or that rehab on the property, now all of a sudden, now the home is worth what all of the other homes are worth. And so if you could get that work done for $20,000, then you legit have $30,000 potentially in equity in that property.
So it's where sometimes flippers can do, right? So somebody that, you know, there's a lot of people that love the idea of flipping or it's kind of glorified because it seems like, oh, I can go get a cheap property. I can put a little bit of work in and I can sell it for more. But the reality is, and you and I both know, that the only folks that do that successfully are the ones that have done so many that they have the ability to go in and do the kind of work cheaper than the other guy. So they're able to find a deal, evaluate it, and then go and do the work. Now, that requires a tremendous amount of time, skill set, and risk. I have a guy, he's a friend, you and I both know him. He's a very successful flipper, but he has to go and raise private money from friends and family. And I know that that's been difficult from time to time for him, and that create some obligations that maybe he doesn't want. Then he's got to find the property. Then he has to go in and do the work, and it'll take a whole bunch of time. We're not even talking about the time that it takes in order to get a property done and flipped or whatever. And then he's able to sell it for a profit. What we see in the outside world and what the shows talk about, the reality shows, or what we see on Facebook or Instagram from folks that do that kind of thing is you see the end result, right? Oh, I bought it for X and I sold it for Y. And we don't talk about anything that happened between X and Y. And that's why a lot of people kind of have the perception that I've got to go and buy a property for way cheaper and then I can sell it for more than I bought it for. And then obviously that makes it for a good real estate transaction. But there's about 1,000 things between those two points on the map that have to happen.
Well, and the other concept with instant equity, so to speak, and if you can find it, great, right?
Sure.
But they're definitely needles in a haystack, and it's more of a job than it is investing. But let's say, for instance, let's say that you found a property, and it's a $2 million property that you can buy for $1 million. Like, is that a good deal?
Right.
Like, it might be,
50% equity position, right?
Like, depending on your situation, it could be a good deal. But for the typical person, like our typical client, that's a horrible deal. Even if you could come up with getting a loan for $1 million, it's like, let's say that you have the ability or the opportunity to buy this and you can kind of sneak into this property somehow. You get a loan for it. Do you know how much the mortgage is on $1 million? Loan?
Not without my mortgage calculator.
Well, suffice it to say, it's well over $10,000 a month.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big obligation.
So if let's say that you weren't able to actually flip it as quick as you needed to or turn it as quickly as you needed to, like, do you have the ability to make a $10,000 a month payment indefinitely until you actually sell the home?
Right.
Like, talk about, like, even if you, like, let's say you had a bunch of money in the bank, say you had an extra $100,000 reserve in the bank. And so you had the ability to make that payment for, say, like 10 months.
Yeah, right.
Can you imagine the stress It's like, oh my goodness, if this thing doesn't close next month, like, not only am I going to lose this home to foreclosure, I will have lost the $100,000 that I put into the payments, you know, on this property.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's the idea, right, of what makes a good deal for you based on your situation. So in that situation, that's why we don't participate in that type of a scenario. Even if we could make $1 million, I would never buy that home because I'm not going to put myself in that type of situation taking on that kind of risk.
Yeah, 100%. So I think the first kind of stop on our journey here is, and we say it time and time again, it's go find a real estate single. And for us, that means a home that a lot of times we say is at or near or below the median value. Do you want to talk to that a little bit, Steve?
Yeah. So for us, like maybe I'll just go down kind of the list of the definition of a good deal, and then we'll kind of take each of these by point. We can kind of let's talk about them. So number one that you mentioned, like this is like maybe like scratching on a blackboard to some like
I'm sure
guru investors or whatever.
Yeah.
But to us, the definition of a good deal is we buy at market value. Because let's face it, 99% of the time you're buying at market value. Okay. And so our definition of a good deal is like one, we buy at market value. Number two, we buy the right size of home to attract the right type of tenant because we believe in rental properties and income generating properties. And for us, that's typically the 3-bed, 2-bath, 2-car garage. We want to be in that market, in that area of buying where you have the largest demand for the property, either to rent it and or to sell it in the future. You want to be in that. You know what a bell curve is, right,
Kev?
You want to be in that sweet spot of the bell curve, that type of a neighborhood.
I always kind of say it's the middle income, middle class type neighborhoods in good areas that make for this type of good investment deal, these single family residences where the vast majority of Americans live and want to live. And that's the key. It's supply and demand.
Now, the other things you want to buy the type of home, like you don't want to buy like a dump, right?
Yeah.
Like you want to buy like the definition of a good deal for us isn't one that has all kinds of structural repairs that need to be done, but just typical, you know, rehab, replace the carpet, paint,
lipstick,
you know, fix this, that kind of a thing. That for us, that's a good deal, not the massive fixer upper.
Yes.
The other part of our definition of a good deal is a property. One in a neighborhood and the type of property that will attract the type of tenant that a property manager will want to manage. And a property manager wants to manage a property that they know they can make a little bit of money on each month. If they know that this property is going to have ongoing repairs, let me let everybody in on a little secret. Property management companies do not make money when they have to make a lot of repairs.
Yeah.
At least not the good ones.
Right.
And so they want to manage properties that are not going to take a ton of their time, effort, and resources. And because like we want our property managers to also make money because that means they're able to do a good job for us and provide a great service.
Sure.
So one that a property that a property management company would want to manage. We of course we want to be able to buy a property that is cash flowing on a cash on cash return of between 5% and 9%.
Yeah.
And not only the cash on cash percentage return, but also the actual cash flow itself, the dollars coming in have to make sense.
Now we'll do another podcast where we really kind of dive into the numbers, but let's touch on these real quick, Steve, because there may be folks listening that, you know, we talk about cash on cash a ton and we talk about this other phrase, this combined cash on cash. Let's actually talk to where those numbers come from just so people kind of know.
Well, so as far as like the cash on cash return, it's like, it's whatever your total out-of-pocket expense to get in that home is. So one, your down payment, which by the way, that's another part of our definition of a good deal is a property where you have put at least 20% down. We advocate actually 25% down because you're able to secure a better interest rate. And that's another part of a good deal is getting the right interest rate, not using hard money loans, but getting a 30-year fixed best interest rate that you possibly can.
From a reputable banking or mortgage institution. Yep, yeah,
exactly. And so being able to define that or how to calculate the cash flow. So you take your total out-of-pocket cost, including the down payment, your closing costs, your rehab costs, any costs associated with the purchase of that property. Right?
Total out-of-pocket.
Total out-of-pocket right there. Let's say it's $50,000. And let's say that your rent is $1,000 a month and your expenses are $600 a month.
Your expenses could be principal interest, tax and insurance on the mortgage, maybe the property management fee, so on and so forth,
A reserve for, you know, vacancy and repairs.
Yep.
So all of that, you got to factor all of that in. And let's say that you're walking away with, for an easy number, $400 a month in net cash flow. 400 times 12, that's $4,800 per year. You take that $4,800, which is your net income on that property, divide it by your total out of pocket, which is, let's say it's $50,000. Take those two numbers, and I don't have a calculator.
I do.
That'll tell you what your cash on cash ROI is.
Yeah. So in this instance, that would be like a between a 9% and 10%
cash on cash. You get a 9% and 10% cash on cash. Like that falls within the range of a good deal for us. And there's two other numbers that we talked about in an earlier podcast, the combined cash on cash and then the annualized return, that we look at those three numbers.
Yeah.
The combined is you're just adding back in your depreciation, your amortized closing costs, and your principal pay down. And that typically will bump up, you know, your how you look at how this home is performing. That number typically falls between like 10 and 15%.
Yeah.
And then your annualized return is factoring in appreciation on top of that number. And that typically will be 15, 17 to 21% yeah. as far as the types of properties we buy.
Yeah. And so the reason why this is important is, remember, this podcast is Replace Your Income. So for us, when we're evaluating a good deal, we want to go find properties that are at market value, that are around, you know, the median home value, which is just indicating that you're looking at homes that are in the highest demand, right? It's a simple supply and demand sort of situation where we want to go and help our clients, and where we go and buy homes in good markets, in good neighborhoods that have good economic sectors and job markets, where people want to go and live, where it's going to be a single family residence, real estate single, two bed, three bath, two car garage. And then we're going to look at it and say, is it cash flowing? And is it cash flowing within the ranges of these numbers that we're talking about right here?
And Kev, real quick,
that's part of the income replacement equation.
The other thing that makes a good deal is one that you can afford.
Yes.
And that's actually why, like, we help our clients buy typically out of state. We have clients in every state in the nation, but we have focused primarily on seven different markets. And right now we're really focused on three different markets. And one of the primary reasons we go to a particular market is its affordability. Yeah. So our average purchase price, right, is $185,000,
yeah, right,
which makes the down payment and the total out of pocket affordable for more people. Like if our market was like Manhattan,
yeah,
you know, that probably wouldn't be a good deal for any other reason other than, you know, the typical person doesn't have that much money for a down payment, yeah, right? So in defining, you know, what makes a good deal, those are pretty unique, you know, factors compared to what many other groups or people, you know, kind of advocate.
And notice we didn't say cap rate one time. Right?
Correct.
Cap rate is this thing that a lot of real estate investors, if you've listened to podcasts, they'll talk all about cap rate, right? Which is just another kind of equation based on the total money you're going to collect on that property versus your purchase price. And so, you know, we kind of look at this and we say, okay, for us, a good deal all boils down to what is a real estate single that we can go hit that's going to assist us in replacing income one property at a time over time. And we're going to look at that through maybe a different set of lenses than somebody else will. And Steve really hit the nail on the head, which is, look, it doesn't matter how you slice up the numbers. If you cannot afford that property, or if getting that property is somehow a massive liability that's going to totally turn you upside down and backwards if the deal goes south, it's probably not a good deal. And that's something that not a lot of people talk about, right? Most of the real estate coaches, most of the real estate companies, most of the real estate gurus, they're not talking about you should be able to afford this. Instead, they're saying, and Steve, you and I have literally seen this. And guys, if you've ever been to a real estate sort of seminar, I'm sorry if you've been exposed to this, but they will tell you to do one of two things. They'll tell you to call your credit card company and somehow raise the limit on your credit card so you can afford their program, so they can teach you how to go and do real estate that frankly maybe you shouldn't afford anyway, but it won't matter because it's not going to be any money out of your pocket because you're going to go to friends and family and go get private money or go get hard money from a private lender. Or they tell you that you ought to go to the back of the room and there's some guy back there with the, you know, going to help you sign up for some kind of unsecured loan or credit card so you can afford the program. So then you can go and try to do real estate that frankly you can't afford. But most of those people don't talk about that affordability factor. And Steve, everything that we do and everything that we try to help our clients do comes down to this. The real estate, yes, there's risk in real estate. Always going to be risk in real estate. You can't avoid it. So you have to mitigate that risk. And I think the way you mitigate, I used to say this all the time when I would go and do seminars or when I'd go and speak kind of about our company or about real estate, I'd say that systems increase predictability. Predictability minimizes or mitigates risk, and a minimized or mitigated risk with a predictable system can increase your potential return. And that is the key. It has to boil down to a system, and it's got to be somewhat scientific. It can't just be, well, that one feels good. There's a lot of real estate investors that go with their gut. And I don't know if you can say going with your gut makes a good real estate deal. There may be some people out there with the most incredible instincts on planet Earth, and they could just look at a deal and somehow the deal speaks to them and they go, that is the property I will purchase. And maybe they're going to kill it, but you can't go off of that. What we try to do is say, what's the system? How do we go and define a real estate single? And then how do we go and make sure that it fits into a framework that works time and time again? Because systems increase predictability. Predictability minimizes or mitigates risk. Minimized or mitigated risk can increase potential future returns.
That's awesome, Kevin. Let me add one more thing. And this kind of encapsulates our philosophy as well. And that is, a good deal isn't a good deal unless it's good for both parties.
I love that. And you know what? I want to end the podcast right here because we've talked about a lot of kind of what makes a good deal. And by the way, throughout these podcasts, we're going to go through specific deals and we're going to talk to specific markets and we have so much that we want to share with you. But this principle that you're about to touch on right here, Steve, I think is so critical to how we operate as humans. And I think that the way you operate as a human, in order to be a good business person, I think you should be a good human. And that's really what this encapsulates. And so please talk to this and let's end the podcast on this thought, because I think it's such a critical piece of deciding whether or not something's a good deal or a good idea to move forward with.
Yeah, for sure. So this whole idea that a deal has to be good for both parties, it's like, it's part of like being able to sleep well at night.
Yeah.
It's part of being able to look at yourself in the mirror and feel like I enjoy what I do. I'm not worried about somebody tackling me from behind because they got screwed on some deal or something, right?
Right.
It's like if you're always concerned about the other side on a deal, on another transaction, you'll be looking at it from the perspective of, hey, look, we can create this win-win type situation. Now, that's not to say that you don't want to negotiate somebody down, because sure, at the end of the day, if they accept your offer, then it's most likely, they're not going to accept something for the most part if it doesn't work out for them, right? So I'm not saying don't be a good negotiator and don't do your best to get the best price, that kind of a thing. But at the end of the day, you don't want to take advantage. You don't want to feel like, man, they got screwed or something to that effect. And of course, you don't want to feel that way, right, yourself.
Now, there are some investors that sort of like, that's how they value the deal.
Pray.
Like, oh man, I threw that guy under the bus. I nailed that dude. Like, that's not what we're advocating at all.
Right. So at the end of the day, that kind of is like the overarching thing that kind of encapsulates everything that we do, is that if it's a good deal for both parties, it's typically not going to be just about the money, although obviously we're doing this for the
That's
money,
right. It's
but it's
profitable.
Also, it's awesome to be in business and to have fun.
Yeah.
And to know that what you're doing is benefiting other people and not just yourself. It truly is Adam Smith's invisible hand at work,
yeah,
right? Where that is the essence of capitalism.
You capitalist pig, how dare you?
If it's good for you, it's probably good for other people.
That's right.
Right. And that's what, motivates people to movement and to take action, is that concept of the invisible hand. So again, just make sure that, you're not taking advantage of some little old lady who's in dire straits and she doesn't really know what's going on with her real estate.
Yeah.
And you could take advantage and walk away with $100,000 and it's only because she didn't really know the real value of her property. It's like, don't do that.
Yeah.
Don't ever do that. And so that's an important factor for us. That's part of what makes a good deal, when both parties can shake hands, meet up on the corner of the street days or weeks or years later and feel like, that was an awesome deal, dude. I'd love doing business with you.
That's right. If you want to hear, there's a great book, if you want to read about what makes up good deals, and it's not like the book says, here's what makes up a good deal, but if you've ever heard of the book, it's, I'm just forgetting the name of it. I'm looking, there it is. It's on my shelf. Winners Never Cheat, John Huntsman. who is a self-made billionaire, and he talks a little bit about how you go about doing deals that benefit both parties. It was a core to who he was, and it served him very well. Listen, Steve and I both believe that the wealth that we create here on this earth in this sort of life that we're leading, it cannot be taken with us when we die and go to whatever that place is that you believe. You know, Steve and I have our beliefs, but what we believe does go with you is some of the choices that you made while you were here. And so I think it's important that you do things that will benefit both parties. So let's just kind of summarize and we'll conclude the episode. When you're looking at a good deal, it should be a real estate single. We generally advocate single family residences, 3-bed, 2-bath, 2-car garage in good, I kind of call them B plus type neighborhoods. Good neighborhoods, good job markets, good economic sectors with affordable purchase prices that are at or below the median, but a purchase price that's at market value and one that's going to mean that with your total out of pocket, it's a property you can afford. And with your total out of pocket, it's going to generate a cash flow for you. And your cash on cash return may range between 5 and 9%. And then over the long run, it's also going to be a deal in a market that's likely going to experience appreciation. We didn't even really get a chance to talk about that, but a deal that's going to experience appreciation so that over time it may appreciate 1, 2, 5, 9% year after year so that when you go to sell that property, you've been able to capture the equity growth. You've been able to collect cash flow along the way. It's been a property that was in a good, desirable neighborhood, in a middle income, middle class neighborhood where you attract tenants that the property managers wanted to work with. And then that property serves you well, it serves the tenant well, and it serves the person well who you bought it from. That was the last point that we made, that these should be deals that are, it's a benefit to the seller, it's a benefit to you as the buyer, and I'd say it's a benefit to the property manager, and it's a benefit to the tenants that are renting the property. And I'd go one step further and say the tenants that are attracted to the property that the property managers want to work with in the right kind of neighborhoods with the right set of conditions are the types of tenants that that the neighbors in the neighborhood would like to have in the neighborhood, right? I think that that's another piece of this. So that across the board, there's a fabulous documentary called The Office. And in The Office, there is an episode called, conflict negotiation or something like that. And that Michael Scott is a big advocate of the win-win-win philosophy. Well, we say the same thing, except there's more than just 2 wins. There's 3 or 4 or 5 wins. There's so many people winning across the board. How does it go wrong when there's that much positive goodness inside of each of these deals? But listen, it's got to be the right type of real estate in the right type of markets with the right set of conditions, with the right philosophy and perspective that allows you to see it for what it is and allow you to cash flow and make money while benefiting others along the way. And that, in a nutshell, is what we look at as a good deal. It is not just a single number on a piece of paper. It's so, so much more than that. So, like always, thank you so much for
joining us. Kevin, all I can say is you rock, brother.
Oh, thanks, man.
You got such a way with words. Anyways, carry on.
Oh, thanks, Steve. That means a lot, man. We are so thankful that you're here. We love you. We love being here with you on this podcast. Thank you for listening. Please subscribe if you haven't and share this with others. We think that there's some good here that can be flooded, that we can flood the world with, and we hope that you agree with us. So thanks as always for joining us on Replace Your Income, and we will see you next week.
Take care.
Thanks so much for listening to Replace Your Income with Kevin and Steve. Do you want to connect with us and other income replacement rangers out to obliterate the status quo and experience real retirement with income replacement through real estate? Type Done For You Real Estate USA in your Facebook search bar and make sure to like our company's page. Send us a message while you're there, and I'll send you a personal hello and make sure you're on our weekly property scouting emails where you can view weekly deals right in your inbox. Until then, thanks so much for joining us on Replace Your Income. And just remember, income replacement for you and your family may only be one property away. See you next week.